Hello, and welcome to a special bought and paid for episode of FW Presents, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly, serving as host for this episode, which is a celebration of the work of comic book writer Roger Stern. Joining me are a couple of Fire and Water all-stars. First, we have one half of JLU Cast, Batman Nightcast, and Superman Movie Minute, Chris Franklin. What's up, Chris?
Hello, everyone.
Next, we have the host slash moderator of Ohapmu or Not. I never really know what your function there is on that show, but also give me that Star Trek and Zero Hour Strikes. What's up, Siskoid?
Everything is up. We're talking comics. Everything's up.
Everything is up. And finally, our special guest and friend of the network, the Pod Crasher, Tim Price. What's up, Timmy?
Hey, Ryan. I'm glad to be here tonight. This is an awesome thing for us to be participating in because, as you said, this is a bought and paid for one. So, and I'm the Patreon who paid for this. So, you know, money talks.
It does. It does. We thank you so much for your money. Listeners, you may remember the last time the Fire and Water Network did something like this, a celebration of a particular writer or artist, was when Marty Pasco died. And unfortunate spoilers, we will be doing another episode for Denny O'Neill very soon. Thankfully, Roger Stern is still alive and kicking. So this episode is not meant to memorialize him, but we're still paying tribute to the comics that he wrote that we love so much. And in that vein, the format of the show is going to be very similar to what we did on the Pasco show. We're going to talk about his career in comics, give some highlights, and then we're all going to talk about some of the comics that we really enjoy and we think that you should read if you haven't already. And you should have. Really, come on, what's stopping you? So, why are we doing this love fest for Roger Stern? This episode is one of our Patreon rewards shows. Now, you may know, if you go to our Patreon page, which is at patreon.com/FWpodcasts, we have different tiers or levels of sponsorship based on how much our patrons choose to donate. And first and foremost, we want to thank everyone who contributes to the Patreon, no matter how much or how little you donate. The fact that you give anything at all is tremendous. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much.
Hear, hear.
But the people who love us just a little bit more, in Tim's case, the people who depend on us to get through one more unimaginably depressing day, those at the Super Friends level get to suggest a topic that, if it's reasonable, may become an episode. And that's how we ended up here. Tim suggested we do a Find Your Joy episode on Roger Stern, who turns 70 years old later this year. So, Tim, this was your idea. Why Roger Stern? What does his work mean to you, and how and when did you discover him?
That's a great question. I really have to think back to when I first started getting my Avengers and Amazing Spider-Man subscriptions in the mail, which was something that happened late in my junior high school years. And I was really hooked on the books back then. Ironically, the writer of Amazing Spider-Man at the time, Denny O'Neill. Interesting parallel that. Mm-hmm. But within like 2 years was when Roger Stern took over writing both of those books. And I was really riveted by those stories. And he was continuing to write them all the way through high school and into when I was in college, the Avengers. He had his time on Spider-Man stopped before then, but he was still writing them into college. And I just really enjoyed the craftsmanship of his books, even though I couldn't have put it that in words back then. He made just gripping characters, gave them interesting stories, kept it high adventure action stories as well, but also could have a very somber and thoughtful dramatic pieces too. So I just was in love with his work very quickly without really even realizing it. And before I knew it, it's like, okay, I'm looking forward to his books almost more than anybody else's. And boy, that just continued into him going to work for DC and the properties that he took on, the new characters he did there, the longstanding characters that he helped helm and write. The fact that he kind of, to me, provided a lot of leadership in the post-John Byrne Superman era. And that was just some wonderful arcs of stories and new directions for the character while kind of building on the foundation that John Byrne laid. So I just was a huge fan of his all along. But and I know I was not an early fan either. I was kind of late compared to some people, but I still had a great affection for his work. And yes, so that's one of those things where I've kind of had in the back of my mind about if I ever was to do a podcast of my own, which I'm not going to because I'm too lazy, I would, it almost would be the kind, he would be kind of the subject matter that I almost want to explore. And I already have floated out there way too many times the title of Bow to Stern as being the title of such podcast. So I've thought about it a lot, but it's like, I know I still haven't pulled the trigger on it. But as you can see, I have a lot of affection for him as a writer, respect for him as a creator. And yes, I did also like check into, and it's like, oh, he turns 70 this year. And when the offer came in to suggest topics for the shows, I still don't have my Friends of the Network t-shirt, by the way. I don't know where that got held up in the mail.
It's probably Jack's fault.
Okay, that makes sense. I double-checked Roger's, Wikipedia, and saw that this was the year of his 70th birthday. It seemed like a very timely year to do a show like this. So that's why I brought it up as a suggestion. And I was so pleased when you guys jumped on it as quickly as you did. I was all like, don't worry, we'll get around to it. We got a lot of great suggestions. We just have to review them and see what we're going to do. And it's like within a week, okay, Tim, we're doing this. When are you available? It's okay. I'm there.
All that and valet parking. You know, what can you ask for?
Siskoid, how and when did you discover Stern?
How did I discover him? That's a good question, because I don't think early on when I was reading like those first Marvel comics in the early 80s for me, I don't think I necessarily picked up on writers' names. You know, it's so early. Mm-hmm. But for real, it's the Avengers. It's actually West Coast Avengers. I know. I had issues of the Avengers, like just random issues. I don't even think I picked them up on the stands. It was like flea market stuff. So I do have a couple of Avengers issues that he wrote or that he edited, because he was editing the title before then. I've seen his name on those books. But it was West Coast Avengers, which seemed to me like that miniseries, a jumping on point. I was not reading Avengers at all month to month. So I just fell in love. I fell in love with Hawkeye, with Mockingbird, with Tigra, with a lot of these characters that I didn't really know or didn't know at all. And then they guest starred on, and this is already the book I'm going to talk about later, but they guest starred on Avengers number 250, which had both teams working on a problem. And from then on, I was reading Avengers. You know, it's like now even though West Coast Avengers, when it popped up, was not written by Roger Stern, obviously I followed that title. But the better written title by then was Avengers, because Roger Stern was at the helm. So now I knew who Roger Stern was. And I followed him, obviously, when DC had the crisis and rebooted Superman. I was all in with that stuff. When Roger Stern left Marvel and joined DC in 87, 88, I was very happy to see his name on that book and on Action Comics and on Superman. So Roger Stern was kind of the guy that I wouldn't say that if his name is on a book, I will buy it. But if his name is on a book and I like the character, then I will definitely buy it. And I will know, I will get a good, steady, you know, it's like, I like these writer spotlights, whether the Pascal one or even like the artist spotlights, like your Gene Colan show, Ryan. Mm-hmm. But I like that we're talking about these, what I consider jobbers. Mm. Like Roger Stern mm-hmm. is not like a superstar. He's no Grant Morrison. He's no Frank Miller. He's no, you know, his name doesn't pop up with the same regularity as some of these more, you know, celebrity writers in a way. But he and several others, Len Wein, for example, Paul Kupperberg, exactly, were all over the place. Jerry Conway, we saw those names all the time when we were kids, because they wrote a majority of books. And it was just like very steady, you know, superhero action stuff that was well written, that was, you know, made you buy the next one, buy the next one, buy the next one, but could also tell one-off stories at the same time. So I think what I like about him specifically, as opposed to some of these other writers, is the personal stuff. You've got your superhero action, but he's the one that's writing like the Avengers are having a baseball game. the Avengers are lounging around the pool, and there's like those kinds of shenanigans. with characters that are otherwise occupied in epic level events. Not a lot of writers do this these days, I feel. It's like those big team books. They're all about the action and about, you know, there's no lounging around. There's no little moments of personality. And I think you mentioned Under Siege. Under Siege doesn't really work if I'm not completely on board and in love with Hercules, with Captain America, with Wasp, with Vision, with all of those guys. If I don't live in their world and feel that personal touch, it's just another big event with big name superheroes in it. But all their personal stories are in their own books, you know? I think he mastered that. And anything that he did, I felt, was always real on a psychological or personal basis, on a, you know, on, from that point of view.
Yeah, I mean, had he been on Avengers for 4 years, maybe, before he did Under Siege? I mean, I think that was that came, like, yeah, he laid the foundation. Yes. He got you invested in those characters before he did it. And I think, yeah, now modern writers would take an Avengers, they would look at it as a story arc that has to be a movie. Like, how would you approach, if you were making an Avengers movie, it has to be that grand scale, whereas Stern was from that era where each monthly comic was a, you know, it was a soap opera in and of itself. Yeah. Chris, what about you?
Well, oddly enough, I think looking on Mike's Amazing World, I tracked the first Roger Stern comic that I know for sure I bought off the rack was Amazing Spider-Man number 223, which I believe was his first regular issue of that title. And I won't hold it against him that it featured the Red Ghost and the Super Apes, you know. But no,
that's a plus. That's a plus. Yeah,
really,
my
cool.
Favorite Fantastic Four villains. Name me one Fantastic Four villain better than the Red Ghost.
There's that one guy that Professor Allen goes on about all the time. But other than him, I don't know. Yeah, it was that run on Spider-Man. I mean, somehow I missed out on the Cap run. I probably because. When it was new on the stands, probably because, you know, Spider-Man titles were probably more plentiful. They got more copies of Spider-Man in on the newsstand, and Amazing Spider-Man in particular. And I had some of the Denny O'Neill issues before this. But that run of Spider-Man that he did with John Romita Jr. back, and I prefer John Romita Jr.'s art style back then. I'm just going to put that out there.
I don't think that's a minority opinion, buddy.
No.
I don't think so either, but I'm just going to say I really liked young John Romita's artwork, Jr.'s artwork. But that run, just a few months after this, they started reprinting the Marvel Tales started reprinting the Lee Ditko issues from the beginning, from Amazing Fantasy 15 on. And so it was the best of both worlds for a Spider-Man fan, because you had this fantastic run that had the feel of that Lee Ditko, but just moving it up, you know, into, you know, modern times with an older, you know, college age or maybe a little bit beyond college age Peter Parker. And then you had the high school stories to read and by Lee and Ditko. So, I mean, it was just like freaking Spider-Man Nirvana. And I just really loved, you know, even at that young age, I just this, you know, once I finally started paying attention to the writer credits, because I did tend to pay attention to the artist credits more, I, you know, thought, hey, man, this Roger Stern guy's all right, you know. And I picked up the odd Avengers issues here and there that he wrote and liked those. But when he left Marvel and went to DC, I like what Byrne did with Superman, but I feel like those years after Byrne left, when it was like Stern, Juergens, Ordway, when those guys were doing the Superman books, and then Louise Simonson and Bogdanov, I felt like those are like my golden age of Superman. I know that's not a state, that's about a statement like saying you prefer young John Romita Jr. But those are like another golden age for Superman, in my opinion, you know, pre-death. And I mean, those stories are, you know, of course, good, too. But I mean, you know, the Crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite and Time and Time Again and all those. He was kind of, you know, I felt like he was the more veteran writer of that crew. And I do kind of feel like he was. I mean, I know Juergens had some, you know, writing under his belt with Booster Gold. But I think that, you know, Stern definitely had more years as a writer. So he was I always felt like he was like the head writer of the Superman books at that time, because Juergens and Ordway had started out as artists, and that's not to take away from them at all. But he brought that, you know, he really did hone in on that that aspect of the continuing soap opera. But as you guys said, and I'll bring this up in the particular issue I'm going to talk about, he never sacrificed that complete story, because we're in the dying days of the newsstand, but he still delivered a complete story. But he also, you know, added to the tapestry a little with each month. And I think he's one of the best at it. And, you know, to my mind, when I see that guy's name on something, I'm like, OK, I'll pick that up. It's Roger Stern. So, I mean, it's just a level of quality and professionalism in comics that's assured with everything he writes.
I think, I mean, as evidence for the point that you were making about Stern's writing over the others, I mean, you look at Ordway, Juergens, Louis Simonson, they were all great storytellers, but when DC needed the novelization of The Death of Superman and other projects like that, who wrote the novelization?
Roger Stern.
There you go. Yep. So,
what is this novel? Your novels? What are those? Oh! The books without pictures. Oh, okay.
As Bart Simpson said, stupid books.
Quote from the best, Ryan. Quote from the best.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, it occurs to me, even as we're doing this, like I've already talked about two Roger Stern projects on Find Your Joy episodes. Some of the first ones I did, Andy Leyland and I talked about a Roger Stern episode of Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man on one of the first Find Your Joy episodes we did. And then, Tim, you and I did the Spider-Man annual that introduced Monica Rambeau, her first appearance.
Yes.
As Captain Marvel, the debut of that. Mm-hmm. We talked about that. And yeah, I knew Roger Stern by name during the 90s as one of the Superman architects, one of the guys behind those, but I wasn't following the Superman titles at the time. And I didn't have much experience with Stern for a long time because 80s Marvel was a blind spot for me for a long time. I mean, I got into comic. I started following the Marvel titles in the 90s, really starting with 1990 and 91. And then I would backfill through because of like essential volumes, the old black and whites and the reprints. So I had the 90s, and then I went through 60s to collect some of my favorite characters, and then the 70s. And the 80s, with a few exception of titles, was kind of a blind spot for me until I started getting the Marvel Digital Unlimited and backfilling some of the Captain America runs and Thors and Hulks and all those other Marvel titles from that era. And then a couple of years ago, Rob Kelly did an episode of Mountain Comics, and I think Michelle Fifu was the guest. And he was just raving about one of Roger Stern's Avengers issues and calling it the best Avengers run ever. And I was like, really? Was that like the one with, like, you know, Hercules and Black Knight instead of Iron Man and Thor? I was like, really, that run? So I read it, and it was incredible. I was so enthralled with this run. And it starts right off the bat. Like, one of my favorite storylines is the trial of Hank Pym, because I love Hank Pym, and I love, you know, when he gets put through the emotional ringer so well. And this three-issue story arc that kicked off this run, I was like, okay, I'm sold. And he had a lineup that I loved from the beginning. It started with the big guns, Cap, Thor, Iron Man, and then Hawkeye, She-Hulk, and Monica Rambeau. And I was like, I really enjoying this. And then it evolved and it morphed and he went through this. But yeah, so I mean, it's just now it is one of those things where if I see his name on a book, I'm like, this is going to be of a quality that I'm really going to enjoy. So quickly kind of going through the highlights of his career at just the big two companies that we're going to discuss. In the early 70s, Roger Stern and artist Bob Layton co-created the comics fanzine CPL, which was contemporary pictorial literature, and eventually that led to them starting the Charlton Bullseye fanzine in 1975. In 1977, he started working for Marvel Comics. His earliest work was writing The Guardians of the Galaxy and Marvel Comics Presents and stories for Iron Man and Thor annuals. The next year, he took over Doctor Strange and The Incredible Hulk. In the 80s, Roger Stern took over writing Captain America with John Byrne art. Unfortunately, their run only lasted 9 issues before they left, because that's what John Byrne does most of the time. At the same time, though, he started writing Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. After 18 months, he moved over to the flagship Amazing Spider-Man title. He also returned for another run on Doctor Strange and briefly took over Ghost Rider for a couple of months. In 1983, he started a beloved 5-year stint writing The Avengers that included the very popular Under Siege storyline that we talked about, as well as the spin-off West Coast Avengers miniseries and the X-Men vs. the Avengers miniseries. When Byrne abruptly left Fantastic Four, Roger Stern stepped in to write a few issues of that, which included the wedding of Johnny Storm and Alicia Masters in issue 300. After a controversial and contested argument with editor Mark Gruenwald, Stern was fired off of the Avengers. After that, feeling like his options at Marvel were limited, although he did write the Speedball series with Steve Ditko, then he started freelancing at DC. He was one of the prime Superman writers for almost a decade, writing Action Comics from issue 600 to 700, along with a bunch of other Superman books in between and after. His other work at DC included The Power of the Atom, The Legionnaires, and the peanut butter and jelly version of Starman. In 2019, Roger was arrested on charges of obstruction and witness tampering during Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's involvement in the presidential election. This past February, he was convicted and sentenced to 40 months in federal prison. Kind of a sad note to end there. That was, wait.
What are you talking about? What?
Hang on a second. Is that Roger Stern?
I thought you were joking.
Roger Stone. Okay, I got the wrong Wikipedia entry. That was Roger Stone. All right. Okay. Wrong Wikipedia entry.
You already got me once before on Tom Price. And no.
Okay, moving on. Did I leave anything out that anybody wants to mention?
I don't know if I wanted to hear what you mentioned already, but
he got to come back and try to straighten out the mess that other writers and editors made of the Hobgoblin.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, he created the Hobgoblin. That was one of the characters that he created. He also created, as we mentioned, Captain Marvel 2, aka Monica Rambeau. Who has appeared in one of the MCU movies as a child in Captain Marvel, and she will appear as a grown-up in the Disney Plus series WandaVision, assuming that ever comes out. He created the character of Union Jack, who has one of my favorite comic book costumes. He was one of the co-creators of Doomsday, along with Dan Jurgens and everyone else working on Superman at the time. He created Maxima, who is Derek William Crabb's favorite character of all time. I just looked this up. He apparently suggested the name Dazzler for that character, who was originally called the Disco Queen.
Ooh, so, Disco Queen's not so good.
No, it's not. So Dazzler was a much better contribution.
He's got a lot of the more you write, the more you create. And I'm sure if Shag Matthews were here, he'd be shining, you know, Starman's car. Or, you know, everybody's got like a favorite Roger Stern creation, even if they don't know that it is a Roger Stern creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, but I'm also happy to talk about the Will Payton Starman also. I mean, I got into that series very quickly, and Roger Stern's name being on it definitely was a draw. And, you know, here's a character that I think also we can see the parallels for why Shag likes him and Firestorm. It's like he's a Marvel character, but in the DCU.
Yeah.
And he really worked so well. We got an interesting character. He had an interesting home life that we hadn't seen before. And it just wove together this delightful story of the newcomer to the superhero world, standing side by side with the giants of Superman and having guest appearances with Batman and even interesting meetups with Power Girl and things like that. It's like there's just so much to love in that series.
All right. Well, we all brought a Roger Stern comic to share with the class. Siskoid, you kind of previewed what you wanted to talk about. So what comic did you bring?
Well, I brought Avengers number 250, kind of like I said, right off the back of, because it comes out right after the miniseries as well, the West Coast Avengers miniseries. So that was my entry into it. Into the Avengers world in a way, even though I'd had a couple issues here and there. I'd even read some French ones, mm-hmm. When I was much younger. But I had no connection to any of these characters. So here it is. It's Mighty Avengers number 250, and everybody's on the cover being held by a fist. It's the West Coast Avengers, which I want to read more of, and I don't know that they're going to have a series yet. You know, that's not been announced. And then there's all these other guys that I don't know, because at this point on this little, you know, box, it's Vision, Scarlet Witch, the Wasp, Captain Marvel, Hercules, and Star Fox. So some of these I know, but many of these I don't. So it's a double-sized issue, and it's got to make me care about all of these guys. And in fact, it did. Not just these guys, but even the villain. I thought after this, I thought Maelstrom was a much bigger deal than he actually was. because, you know, in this, his plan is to stop the Earth's rotation. And that actually stayed in my imagination as a kid. What would happen to Earth if, like, it would be baked on one side and frozen on the other. And there's an image of that. And this is so early in my comic book reading that many of these images, now I had like to dig through comic book boxes, and I almost ripped my arm out because it, of course, it was the last box I looked in, and it was underneath a lot of other boxes. But when I opened the pages, it's like, well, I remember all these images, and a lot of this is just seared into my brain. What really caught my attention was, well, obviously the writing, but there are moments in here where they are by the pool, where the girls are sitting there. Hercules comes up. He's new to the team at this point. He just wants to, it's fun to be with people kind of vibe. And he's wondering what they're doing. They're timing Star Fox, who's holding his breath in the pool. Star Fox comes out. There's water everywhere. The Wasp is incensed because it wet her hair. So she's spending like the next briefing just with a towel and still drying herself off. So all of these little personal moments, and it ends with the two Avengers teams together at the Avengers compound in Los Angeles, and they're having a barbecue. You know, it feels so homey, and I was used to this from, like, the X-Men did sort of stuff like this, but they all lived together. They were roommates. I don't know. You know,
right.
It was kind of that vibe with an extra layer of maybe they're all lesbians. But with Avengers, you could tell the friendships, and some people were colder than others. Some people were newer and just getting to know each other. And Roger Stern tracks all of these relationships. And there's one nice moment that I like a character moment, is when the two Quinjets are flying to Maelstrom's island lair. And it's two facing pages, and you see both teams in their Quinjets, and there's dialogue, but people are thinking. There's the East Coast Avengers, and they're thinking stuff, and they're mostly trying to calm Captain Marvel down because she's been hit with one of the villain's fear powers, so she's very, very anxious, and then you know, that's what's going on there. But on the other side is the West Coast Avengers, and they're all new to each other. And especially, like, Iron Man is actually Rhodey at this point. So he's new to it in a way, and he feels a little out of place. And he's saying, well, if we could take care of Graviton, so he's talking about the miniseries, if us five could take care of Graviton, then us 11 can take care of this Maelstrom jerk, right? And then everybody has a thought bubble around him, and every thought bubble starts with, I hope Iron Man's right. And then, like, their way of thinking, and the next person, I hope Iron Man's right, and their little thought process. And then when you get back to Iron Man, he's thinking, I hope I'm right. So it's stuff like this. This is, like, the comic is a lot of drama, a lot of superhero action. The angst and the drama of a Marvel comic is there. A lot of good use of superpowers, reversals, you know, people are thinking things through. But also, you know, even like the little guys, you got Mockingbird just trying to hit. Maelstrom is a giant at this point, and she's just going at it with the batons. And they're just like, they know they're insects to this guy. But everybody's like doing their part anyway, and having their own little moment and their own little drama in the action. But then there's also this humor where you can find it, which is in the personal moments, in their thoughts. So reading this again was like everything. I remembered everything, but all the things I didn't remember, which was like the peculiarities of the writing like the words used and who thinks what and who does what exactly. That's where I found. Well, let's use the motto. That's where I find my joy in this one. So, I mean, I couldn't have started a better place. No, 250. It's a celebration. It's an anniversary issue, collector's item, double sized, two teams, and that can easily go south. Too many characters. Some aren't serviced as well as others. You know, things can go wrong the more characters you put in, as evidenced by any crossover event you've ever read. But in this case, it all works. He likes all these characters. You know, it's not. Even the West Coast Avengers is a team he put together. So he likes them. He's giving them the boost. And of course, they're going to be written by someone else afterwards. And I don't think they ever were as good as in the miniseries. But still. So at this point, they're still his characters, his team. And so are the East Coast Avengers, obviously. To me, that was magic, and it kept me reading for the next 5 years.
I was just thinking, I remember thinking this at the time because I read the first year and a half or so of West Coast Avengers in an omnibus edition a couple of years ago. And I remember getting to the main series when Steve Englehart took it over. And I like a lot of what Steve Englehart has done. I'm a big fan of a lot of his career. But the entire time I'm reading those issues, I'm thinking, I wish Roger Stern had stayed on this book, and he had been writing the whole thing. If he could have been writing both Avengers books at some time, if he could have made that work, I think
one of the interesting things, and listening to Chris talk about, you know, his work on Superman and working with the other writers, is how much of a collaborator he is. Because even at this point, or just after this point, he will be working in tandem with the West Coast Avengers writer. And then when he moves to DC, it's a team. It's a writing team working on Superman. And when he leaves Superman, he's on a writing team for the Legion. Legion has two books. He's co-writing one of the two titles with Tom McCraw. And there's always a credit for Camilla Merlo, I think, whatever her name is, which is his wife. So she was also like a co-plotter on these Legionnaire books, and she always got some kind of credit for the ideas or for, I don't know. A lot of his projects that we best remember were actually collaborative books, collaborating not just with your own artist and editor and your own creative team, but collaborating with other books and coordinating things with them. There wasn't a whole lot of coordination between West Coast and East Coast, but there was some. I feel like one of the Roger Stern's qualities must have been that he was a good team player.
Tim, I assume that you have read Avengers 250. Chris, have you?
I have not read that one. Like I said, my Avengers run of Roger Stern is spotty. It's something I definitely need to rectify someday. I have read Under Siege, but I have not read every single issue of his run.
I have read it. In fact, I had to go and pull it out because when Cisco had mentioned it, it's like, okay, I got to go pull it out because I love that story. I love that story a lot for all the things you mentioned. I even think that I'm trying to remember if there would have been a story that I had read yet which felt like this much of a crossover in my limited experience of the Avengers up to that point. I mean, they'd had probably like the membership issues where they'd have lots of guest stars all at once in those. But this is like them all joining up to fight a single menace. And it's like, I know they, and having read more older Avengers stories by now, I've now seen plenty of stories like that. But this felt big at the time because I had also gotten the West Coast Avengers miniseries that came out, which I can't sing its praises high enough either. It was just a wonderful and a great package, a four-issue story that really just clicked right along and made you care about those characters. And he pulled together a great group of characters. I loved every bit of that. And seeing these two great tastes together in one story so soon after that miniseries finished, I really just wanted more. So I couldn't agree more with the idea that if he had been the regular writer for West Coast Avengers, that would have been just phenomenal. And just the mind boggles at how he would have made these teams work together if he'd had the chance to do that. You know, they've been working together even closer.
Yeah, I have to mention that Hawkeye is my favorite Marvel character of all time. And I've said this before in other shows. Why? It starts with that miniseries. It starts with that portrayal of Hawkeye as the guy who really looks up to Captain America, and now he's got his chance to have his own team, and you know, he's got a model, he's got a role model, but he's got to do it his way. Right. And him seeking to build a team that is his own, and actually failing in a way, because he never finds that sixth member, does he? So I think that is Hawkeye, and I think he was portrayed like that through still through West Coast Avengers when it wasn't Roger Stern writing it, through solo Avengers where he got his own, you know, half of an issue every time. You know, the Hawkeye that I love is that, well, I've loved Hawkeye since, but the Hawkeye I fell in love with was this guy, and it was Roger Stern's Hawkeye. And I think, like, even like an earlier story that I can pinpoint to say that, okay, I love Hawkeye in this issue, was still edited by Roger Stern. So his fingerprints are all over the place.
Yeah.
I was just looking at his Avengers run, and I think the first issue looks like it's 227. I bought that one right off the stands with Captain Marvel, with Monica Rambeau, and that's right after her and She-Hulk joined the team. And I had quite a few through that a bit there, and I didn't really know a lot of the secondary Marvel characters at the time. You know, mostly it was Spider-Man, Cap, and the Hulk, and you know, I was meeting a few on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends when they'd have, you know, Australian Wolverine drop by and things like that. But and the Cyclops that goes Juggernaut like that. But it was great. I mean, you know, it was kind of like a, you know, opening up the Marvel universe in a way to, you know, a lot. I mean, you know, on this very cover, he's got Reed and Sue Richards on the cover too. So he's packing it. He's packing it chock full of Marvel goodness for, you know, a fairly newbie, Marvel guy like Moose, just dipping his toe in past the big three at the time, you know?
What's also kind of fun about this, about particular issue you picked out, Siskoid, is that this also ties into this episode you and I did, Ryan, about Captain Marvel, is that this is one of the few places where her scientist friend from her origin story also appears. So for those of us who read that origin, we're getting another tie in and building her history, her character. And that's, you know, cementing when we talk at that episode that, yeah, Monica was really very much his character, and it's like very sad to see her fade when he left the book. Thankfully, she's kind of come back a bit more in more recent years. But he was really building her up, and he had a vision for her. He had an arc for her, and it's continuing in this very issue. So that's really cool.
Chris, what did you bring to the table?
Well, I thought I would try to bring a little DC to the table here. I debated back and forth, and I'll give a shout out to another beloved set of comics that Stern wrote at Marvel. But I thought some mention should be made of Action Comics number 662, February 1991, on sale January the 8th, and it had art by Bob McLeod. And that's a very important issue in Superman history, because this is the one where Superman finally reveals his secret identity to Lois. Not a hoax, not a dream, not an imaginary story, and not on Earth 2 either. This is old post-crisis DC Earth, and it really happens. And Stern does a great job, because of course he does. But so the story starts out, there's a wicked storm raging in Metropolis. Two issues before, Stern had killed off Lex Luthor. Lex was dying of kryptonite poisoning, you know, cancer from kryptonite poisoning. And so he went out in a blaze of glory in his own jet. And, you know, Metropolis and the world is reeling from the death of mogul Lex Luthor. And so there's this low-level attorney, like, searching through a LexCorp tower to try to find if Lex Luthor had any kind of will that would name who his heir is. And then we cut across to Lois Lane's apartment, and her and Clark had become engaged in the wonderful Crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite storyline that Roger Stern also contributed to. But Jerry Ordway got to write the issue where Clark pops a question that time. But they're having a nice night at home, and they're, you know, snuggling on the couch and, you know, having a romantic evening. But Clark's really, it's weighing him down. He's decided, okay, if I'm going to marry this woman, I've got to tell her. I can't marry Lois and keep the secret that I'm Superman, because unlike the pre-crisis Superman of the 60s, this Clark Kent isn't a dick. So, you know, But so, you know, Clark's trying to build up his courage to talk to Lois. You know, he's trying to give her, you know, have you ever had, you know, secrets that you've never told anybody? And Lois is kind of, oh, man, if you knew some of the stuff I did, you know, if my dad knew what I did back in high school, man, you know, and he's like, yeah, you're not getting it, you know. And so there's this knock on the door. And, you know, it's this totally human moment where Lois and Clark are just, he's trying to tell her something. And the Silver Banshee just, like, busts through the door and starts choking the crap out of Clark. And she's calling, you know, Superman, where's Superman? And, of course, I got to give it to Lois. She throws the bowl of popcorn at her. You know, she's get off my man, you know. She realizes that Superman's not there, which I'll get to later. You know, Lois thinks Clark might be dead. She can't get a pulse on him, which maybe she can't get a pulse on Superman. I don't know. So he comes to and he tells her that he's got to go and get word to Superman about Banshee. And she's trying to get him. No, you need to stay here. He's like, I've got to find Superman. Obviously, she's looking for him and she's very dangerous. This is like probably like he's fought the Silver Banshee several times before, including some stories by Roger Stern right as he came on the Superman title where he revealed her backstory. Byrne had introduced her, but not really fleshed out her backstory before. So Superman tracks the Banshee's whale to the Daily Planet. The two battle, and she overcomes him because she's magic, of course. So she takes him to this wrecked cathedral, and she's ready to behead Superman because she's taking these commands from this disembodied voice, and you're not sure who it is. But if you read the Superman books at the time, you probably got a pretty good idea of who it is. And Superman stirs the consciousness just in time, and he's able to defeat her because basically Blaze, the demon Blaze, who has been pushing her into direction to get revenge on Superman, decides to basically leave her hanging, and Banshee disappears. And Lois, you know, back at her apartment, the powers went out for the storm, and Clark returns, and he wastes no time. He gets right back to the subject at hand. He tries to ease her into it. He talks about having secrets that were held for so long. It's difficult to talk about them because you're not sure how somebody is going to take it. And she, you know, she tells him that, you know, she, you know, again, she thinks she knows what he's talking about. It's okay. You can tell me anything. And, you know, then the moment, you know, he takes the glasses off, he starts unbuttoning her shirt, and then you get the full page splash reveal of Superman, half Clark, half Superman, no cape, just the shirt with his Clark Kent shirt unbuttoned and his trousers still on, which is kind of a weird look really, but it makes him more vulnerable and more human. I don't know if that was Stern's direction or Bob McLeod, but it works really well because he's not standing there hands on hips. I'm Superman. You know, it's like, hey, Lois, I'm Superman. And it's this real human moment. And it's at the end of a comic now. And I don't want to get on this, you know, all these writers nowadays, Bob, but I can't help it. This comic, you know, it's not. This is the very end of this comic. This is a huge moment for these characters, but Stern makes it more of an actual real moment for people. It's not 22 pages of them talking, building up to it. No, Superman's life is, you know, one emergency after another. So of course he gets interrupted before he gets a chance to tell something important like this. And, you know, I'm sure this was the whole Superman team. They had those famous Superman conferences. Mike Carlin would get them all together and they'd plan what they were going to do. And then somebody, you know, would invariably say, let's kill him, until they actually did. But, you know, in this case, you know, they all probably decided it was time. You know, they were engaged. She needs to know. But the way he did it, you know, and Stern was one of the people who. I'm trying to be kind here, but John Byrne's Lois was a bit of a hard pill to swallow sometimes. He took the Phyllis Coates Lois and amped her up to like 11 as in Spinal Tap term. She was a little acidic sometimes. So the Stern and Ordway and Juergens had really made the Clark Lois relationship work. You were ready. They made you ready for this to happen. It was a much more organic than the whole Peter and Mary Jane thing over at Marvel, in my opinion, which just seemed, whoa, where'd that come from? And, you know, they set, you know, Stern sets this up, and it's, it, you know, it's continued. It's, you know, I mean, other than the New 52, when, you know, that was relaunched, you know, Lois has been in on the secret. I mean, in, you know, on TV series and of course, the movies just went right straight to it. The you know, the Man of Steel DCEU movies pretty much went straight to it. In the first film, Lois knowing the secret has become part of the canon. And I think, you know, Stern was and the others were smart to think, okay, you know, if we want people to take Lois seriously as a character, then she needs to be trusted with this. And also, I think Stern was also smart in kind of a sly way to have Silver Banshee not recognize that Clark was Superman. So that helps you buy that Lois never figured out that Clark was Superman, just a little bit, because, you know, that's going to come up. But I mean, this overall, I mean, it's just an example of how Stern was able to take this. You know, he gave you the monthly comic, had plenty of action, had a good supervillain. You know, if you're a kid buying this off the newsstand, you got what you wanted. If you're a little bit older and into the relationships and into the characters, it was a humongous payoff to have, you know, Clark finally reveal this secret. And, you know, I mean, it's momentous, but it's not stagey. It's a very organic presentation of something that could have been just way over the top and kind of lost that human feel that he gives it.
Cisco and Tim, either of you guys read this one?
Of course.
Yes.
All right,
that's
all
right. It's a great pick, Chris. That's a fantastic pick, Chris. That's all I got to say right there. That's a wonderful pick because it's a fantastic story all the way from beginning to end. All the things you said, I just stand behind you saying, yeah. That's all okay. I can do.
Thank you.
Well, certainly one of the things that I found in the Avengers books as well, and it was true of his Superman work, is that with Roger Stern, you get the soap opera, you get the like the that moment, that reality, but you're also getting, he never skimps on the action. Mm-hmm. You're always going to get an action mm-hmm. story as well. So here, if they're having conferences, and it's hard to know with the Superman books who came up with what exactly, unless you've read the right interviews, I guess. But who came up with what at the conference? You know, they're working as a group of writers and an editor in the room, and who knows? But you know, it's like working on television. You are still, even though you're in a writer's room, you're still assigned a certain script, and it's up to you to make those moments work. We've decided that they're going to, and they have to, obviously, if they already decided that they're going to get married or they're already engaged, and I think that's all that tracking of that relationship is so important. And not to take anything away from Juergens or Ordway, but those guys, you know, they were artists first.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that they didn't have any of these ideas, but Roger Stern had much more experience with writing the superhero soap opera and tracking it for a long time. And I love that in that whole era, the decisions are that we're going to get these two engaged, and they're really divorcing Lois Lane from Superman. They're making Lois Lane fall in love with Clark Kent. And that's the big paradigm shift compared to the previous continuity, let's say. So once you've decided that, and then you know, it's unfurling at a steady pace until, yes, this moment must exist. And it's like Ordway got to do the proposal, but Stern had to write, I think, this more difficult piece, which is, you know, you're kind of on a... It's a high wire act, this thing, to make sure it works, that you're still delivering a good comic, that it's not just talky. But, you know, it's like I like those moments, the popcorn moment. And that's those like little human moments that Roger Stern is able to write into the narrative and then, you know, actually sell us on that Kerpow moment. It's like the most quiet Kerpow moment ever, but it is a Kerpow moment. Mm-hmm. As we call them.
Yeah.
And then it's somebody else's turn to obviously talk about what comes out of that, the consequences of that moment. But the moment works in and of itself, you know. So, yeah. Yeah.
I hadn't read this one until you recommended it. My reading of Superman from this era is a little bit spotty, but I was thrilled when I started to read it that it included Silver Banshee in this issue, because I love that character. She's one of my favorite Superman villains, just to come out of this era. She's probably in my like top five Superman villains. I really like that design, the look of her, and how she's used. So it was fun that he included her in a story this important.
Yeah, I like the fact that, you know, really his – usually if something – in a book like this, if there's a big monumentous thing going to happen, the adventure that the hero has with the villain will play into what he's going to do. But really, it didn't. It didn't. What Silver Banshee – it was really like it's just part of – that's just another – it's an aspect of his life that Lois is going to have to deal with, that, you know, he's Superman. He's on call all the time. But other than that, it did not change his resolve in any way. He just got interrupted. I thought that was neat. It wasn't. It was literally a distraction from what he wanted to do that night. You know, which, you know, and it's like another. It was another night in the life of Superman, which I thought was an even better way to go than to have it, you know, really tie into to what you know, to make Clark push him to make that decision.
All right, Tim, what did you bring for us?
I think that the tone of what I have kind of follows the track that we're going through here of getting more and more low key and more personal in terms of the storytelling, because I brought Amazing Spider-Man number 248, because I can't really think of a single issue that I think encapsulates Roger Stern's way of bringing emotion to the characters than the story in here. And of course, I'm talking about Spider-Man's fight with Thunderball, where it's a nice big old slugfest at the beginning and is way outclassed with a guy who's almost as strong as Thor because he's got the Wrecker's wrecking bar as well. And it's a little reminiscent of the earlier issue of Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut, which was a fantastic action story there. But at the end of the day, I was like, no, I'm not here talking about that part of the story. What's amazing is he wraps up that story in 11 pages, and he still has half a book to go. We have the Ron Friends 11-page story in the back called The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man. And I just got to say right now, when you're in the mood for a good cry, this is the story to read, because it makes me cry every single freaking time I read it. Now, granted, this story came out in 1984. There were some really rough things going on in my life at that time, so I definitely had some perhaps some raw emotions there. But still, in all, the story is just so moving, because we have a young boy named Timothy Harrison. Hey, Timothy, interesting. Who is a huge fan of Spider-Man. And a columnist for the Daily Bugle is writing a story about him. And we see the articles about Tim being placed throughout this story. But the main part of the story is that Spider-Man goes to visit young Tim. And it's really an Ohotmu entry, right? Or a Secret Origins story, right? Because he's telling, we see him using his powers. He talks about how he got his powers, his origin. Shows his gadgets, and we hear a lot about what motivates him. Why does he do what he does? What sort of problems has he had in his life? All those things come out. And it's all in the context of talking to Tim about that, which makes Tim, like us, the reader, we're experiencing this secondhand as the person that we idolize is explaining it to us. And, you know, you're living that ultimate fan moment where you get to meet your hero, and your hero is everything that you'd hoped he would be and more. He's just he becomes a friend along the way. And that's what we all want to see of our heroes. But as we go along, we don't really know why Spider-Man came to see him in the first place. But then we have that moment at the end when Tim very quietly asks, "Who are you really under the mask?" And I was floored the first time I read this, when Peter Parker takes off the mask, saying who he is and that he took most of the pictures that are in Tim's scrapbooks. And it's like, what is going on here? What's happening? What would bring Peter, who has guarded his secret identity so closely his whole career, to expose it to a child? someone who is perhaps, you know, might not be quite as mature and able to really handle the responsibility of knowing this without revealing it accidentally even. But then they go in for a hug goodbye, and we see the tears in Peter's face, and it's like, okay, what's going on? And we turn the page to the last page, and it's all silent panels, and Spider-Man is swinging, and he stops on a wall, and you can see that he's got his hand in his face in his hand crying, and it's a cancer clinic. And the last part of the newspaper article about Tim comes up saying that the young man only has a few weeks left to live. And if that just, you know, that's just a punch in the stomach, just makes you, I'm already tearing up. For freak's sake, I'm tearing up. Okay, I'm sorry. Anyway, but it's a...
That's all right, you paid for it.
Beautiful. All right, yeah, so y'all be quiet. there's everything about this story is just perfectly, it doesn't rush it. It doesn't really, it can feel like melodrama, but it really just felt genuine. The voice of young Tim feels so genuine, and his love of and fandom of Spider-Man, you know, because we see the very interesting little tidbits that they brought to the story as well that are just outside of the origin. Like the fact that Tim managed to get a hold of film from his initial TV appearances from way back in Amazing Fantasy number 15. You know, some used bullets that he managed to pry out of a wall that Spider-Man had dodged. And the funny part of a scrapbook devoted completely to Jonah Jameson's retractions. That's hilarious. But we see it gives us a whole big picture of who this young man is and what he's about. And it's like what we are, you know, for those of us who are fans of Spider-Man, he's us. But then it takes that turn and, yeah, we get to see why. I think that in a way, if this story had if the article had been written about this young man, Peter might have shown up anyway. But there was definitely an urgency to it, and you can see that we needed that. That was that he knew that Tim needed this, so he was there for him. He was going to be Tim's hero in this way, in this very quiet way. So I ought to stop talking because it's making me break up again. But yes, this is to me one of Stern's masterpieces.
I agree. I was on an episode of Radio Versus the Martians with Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. I think early in 2019. So yeah, more than a year ago, I think. And like we were talking all about Spider-Man, and at the end, like when it came down to sort of like recommendations or sort of the high points, like some of the best stories, the two that I thought of that at least for me in at the time had the most immediate emotional resonance for me was the movie Into the Spider-Verse that had come out just a few months prior, and then and then this short story. I think these were the two that were kind of stuck in my mind as being the Spider-Man stories that had the most emotional punch for me. And yeah, for just being what feels kind of like a backup story that might get skipped over. This is, it occurs to me because I just read a quote just about an hour before we read this about a writer saying that, you know, Batman was the most human of the superheroes. I was like, no. Batman might, you know, if you shoot him, he reacts the same way humans do. But for me, I've always found the humanity in Peter Parker and Spider-Man a lot more prevalent than in Batman. And this story certainly gets to the core of that. Siskoid, Chris, your thoughts on this one?
First of all, Tim shouldn't feel bad about breaking up on if I had a buck for every time my voice wavered on a podcast, I could probably buy a mint copy of this comic, you know?
That's because Bass is very, very cruel to you on those shows.
Yeah. The girls maybe break down, but no, I mean, when I talk about something I think the Star Trek shows are pretty bad for that. You know, there are moments, movie moments and TV moments that really go and grab me. And there are comic book moments as well that are like that, you know? So this is actually a comic that I have not read. I've heard of it, because it is it's in the top of many. Ryan wasn't actually breaking new ground when on Radio versus the Martians there, because publications about Spider-Man mentioned this story. The Wikipedia page mentions this story specifically, you know. So it is very often in people's tops. And if you look at, there once upon a time, I was reading a lot of blogs. And when, best 10 Spider-Man stories, best five, that story would invariably be in it. But Stern's Spider-Man work is more or less a blind spot for me. He wrote that before I started reading a lot of Marvel comics, or a lot of American comics for that matter. So it's still in that blank period for me.
Chris, did you mute yourself?
I'm sorry. I muted myself. Yeah. That's the first time I think I've ever done this.
I was crying. Sorry.
It's okay. let the feelings out. Let them out.
I'm pretty sure anybody who listened to the superhero movie bracket show when Superman 2 beat Superman the movie, I'm pretty sure we all heard Chris pretty close to tears.
Yeah, that was the first instance in the past few years that tested my faith in humanity, but not the last. But no, seriously, this, when I bought this off the stand, I was buying Spider-Man regularly, and the cover is just, you see the kid, he's holding the poster where Spider-Man's fighting Thunderball and cue the Tom Jones, and it's a great cover, but you have no idea of this story. And you get inside and you switch from John Romita Jr., doing his somewhat John Romita Sr. Pastiche at the time, to Ron Frenz doing a very Ditko pastiche. Here. I mean, it's like, oh, what, did I accidentally pick up Marvel Tales? Which I loved it, because I love Steve Ditko Spider-Man. So, Tim, I'm so glad you picked this, because this is the first comic book that ever made me cry. I was like 8 years old, and I don't even know if I knew kids got cancer at 8 years old. Seriously, I don't know if I did. I mean, that was before, St. Jude's commercials were on all the time and things like that. And I didn't know anybody personally. I had a friend who had leukemia, but at one point, but I don't even know if I knew that that was a form of cancer or anything like that. So I was just floored, and I was the same way. I'm like, he took off his mask. What? He's like, I just, there's that one old, Marvel Tales issue where, he rips his mask and fighting Sandman, and he's freaking out about how Aunt May is going to, he's going to be thrown in jail, and Aunt May is going to be on the street poor and all this stuff. He wouldn't take his mask off for anything. And then you get to that last page and I'm just like, oh my God. And it could be some, you could see it that it's a little melodramatic, but it's so under the radar. It's in the back of the book. They don't a very special episode. I mean, they kind of do, because the cover's different than a lot of other Spider-Man covers, but it's still not, a very special episode of Different Strokes or whatever. It just sneaks in on you, and it definitely deserves to be at the top, the top 10 list of anybody's Spider-Man stories. If you've ever read it, I mean, I highly recommend everybody. If you need a good cry, I can't agree more, Tim. You nailed it. It's the tops. What I also like about this one is that when we read the story itself, there's so many panels that have no dialogue in them. And that's another testament to Roger knowing where to set up the scene and let the words get out of the way. And he told that we see that on every moment that he does that in this book. It's like, that's very deliberate. And because writing Spider-Man, you have to do a lot of thought balloons to have the monologue going. Otherwise there'd be like no speaking at all with how much time he spends on his own. And Peter Parker is in his own head an awful lot, but in this story, he can't be in his own head. He's there for Tim. And that's another thing I just love about that. But yeah. And the artistic tone, I mean, that had to be on purpose, getting someone to come in and kind of really channel Ditko to make this story that sell it all the more. Yes. So, yes, I'm done.
Yeah, I think his scrawnier Ditko-esque Spider-Man makes him seem all that much more human in this story versus the more super heroic John Romita Jr. or senior Spider-Man in the earlier part of the story. So.
I think the punchline of the story, which is unspoken but crystal clear, and is also like the core, maybe the nugget of where the story began, which is kind of the expression, keeping a secret to the taking a secret with you to the grave, which is kind of glib and crass if you take it literally. And in this case, he's like, I'm going to tell a story that takes that expression literally and make you feel it and make you understand the weight and the enormity of that. Is that who can Spider-Man trust with this secret? If he's got to tell somebody, he can trust somebody who won't have the opportunity to blab to Kingpin or put it online or do something like that. And it takes a sort of flippant expression and punches you in the face with it, and that's what he can. That's what a genius writer can do. So,
yeah, I would say this story is the reason that I called total BS on the comic version of Civil War, because Peter Parker wouldn't just willy nilly reveal his secret identity to anybody. You know, so there.
There's a lot about
you're not. You're not wrong. Yeah. You're not wrong.
All right, we're going to change gears quite dramatically, and I'm going to talk about a story that is a lot more humorous. I didn't even want to talk about a comic. I'm going to talk about the movie Private Parts, which is based on the book in which Roger Stern's autobiography, he talks about how he started off as a radio shock jockey before becoming an...
Ryan?
What?
That's Howard Stern.
Oh, son of a bitch. Did it again. Okay.
How are you doing your research again?
I don't
trust autocomplete. What are you doing? Do not just click the first thing that autocomplete pops up for you.
Okay, backup pick. We'll go with my backup pick.
Yeah, I was already on IMDb looking this up.
Jesus. Okay.
A movie? I'm going, whoa.
All right, my backup pick is the Marvel graphic novel Doctor Strange, Doctor Doom, Triumph, and Torment. As I mentioned before, Roger Stern had been writing Doctor Strange for a while. He kind of did two runs on him, but he came back in this one to do this graphic novel, which, even though Strange gets top billing, this is much more of a Doctor Doom story, but it sets off where in... elderly sorcerer, not quite the ancient one, but somebody of that ilk, basically summons all of the sorcerers on Earth to this one location. And it's a brutally deadly contest where the Vishanti, the spirits that the sorcerers can call on, have all of these, throw all of these, the sorcerers into a combat where they have to rescue somebody. And the last sorcerer standing gets a boon, where they get a favor, is sort of granted. And in this case, Doctor Strange is the last one standing, but he is also there with Victor Von Doom, who there's some controversy. Does he belong here with the other sorcerers? Do we trust him? Why is he there? Victor is also standing, but Doctor Strange performs the ultimate spell that kind of seals the deal and wins it. So through this, the Vishanti say, yes, Stephen Strange, you are the Sorcerer Supreme. You have the status. But to be the Sorcerer Supreme demands a lot of somebody, including certain sacrifices. And it's a heavy burden. And one of the burdens that you must bear is we are not granting you the favor. That is not the part of the contest. The favor that is granted is the Sorcerer Supreme must grant a favor to one of the other sorcerers here in the contest, and that is Doctor Doom. So the start of the story ends up with Doctor Strange owes Victor Von Doom a favor. And a short time later, Von Doom approaches it. He summons Doctor Strange. He's like, you are going to help me go to hell and save the soul of my mother. And we see part of Victor Von Doom's backstory with his parents and his mother, who was this, they called Gypsy at the time, but a Romani, who was murdered and then condemned to hell. So Von Doom's plan is basically, we need to breach hell and save her soul from Mephisto. So Strange's like, all right, this is not going to be an easy favor, but these are the rules, and if the stakes are your mother's soul, I'm going to trust that you won't betray me. So they work together, they do all this prep, they go into hell, By the way, I didn't even mention this story is illustrated by Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy. So imagine him doing Doctor Doom and Mephisto and everything like that. And within the story, once they get there, Doom meets Mephisto, and of course he betrays Doctor Strange because it's Doctor Doom. He betrays Strange in order to get his mother's soul. But when she realizes that Victor, her son, betrayed the man that he had pledged to work with in order to save her, she rejects him. And she says, no, you're not my son. This is not what I want. And she sacrifices her soul to put it back in hell in order to save Strange. Strange then realizes that this was part of Victor's plot, and they were working together to beat Mephisto. When Victor's mom sacrificed herself to remain there in order to save Strange, she kind of redeemed her soul. Therefore, her soul was no longer belonged to Mephisto, so she can go to heaven. She can't go back to Earth, but she can ascend to heaven. And in that sense, Von Doom saved her. Dr. Doom saved her the way he wanted to. And also, Mephisto can't get her soul back, and he can't if he kills Doom and Strange. Then he doesn't get their souls because they're still pure. So Mephisto is just, you know, kicking rocks, and he's pissed off, and he kicks them all out of hell. So Strange is, at the end of it, Strange is kind of like, so was this your plan all along? You were going to betray me knowing that your mom was going to do the thing that would save herself? And Doom has the last word. He's like, I don't have to explain myself to you. Get the hell out of my castle. So it's really just, it's a cool story that sends these characters to hell. It's ostensibly a Strange story, but it's really about Dr. Doom, and you get to see him be a character who is the villain that we know and love, but also a character who has a lot of humanity, a lot of turmoil in his soul, and is very self-centered in doing the thing that he ultimately wants to do, which is selfish, and he's willing to sacrifice other people, but it's for the sake of his mom, so it's this human moment, and that's what Stern was able to do in the story, and it's a really fun read. So highly recommend that one. Doctor Strange, Doctor Doom, Triumph and Torment. Any of you guys read this one before?
I have always wanted to, and I never got my hands on it, so I've never read it, unfortunately.
It's available digitally. It's been collected now in the Doctor Strange Epic Collection. There's one called Triumph and Torment, which collects the first year of the 90s Sorcerer Supreme series. But it's also got this graphic novel in that one. So, Tim, Siskoid, yeah. Either of you read this?
I have read this one, and I did read it on the Marvel Unlimited app. In fact, I don't know why I picked it up. But it just came along as exploring the app, I guess, because I was more or less random. It's not like I went on a Doctor Strange or Doctor Doom binge or anything. But I knew of it, and I'd heard of it, but I guess something maybe just decided to pick it up. So I only read it like a couple years ago, and yeah, it just blows me away. Of course, I also know you really picked this issue because Mephisto's in it. I know that's really why you did that, and because I was going to be on this show too. So you just tell me what line from Mephisto you want me to read, and I'll do it. But
if, you know, it, you yeah, see, we a, are dumb, but we are not so dumb.
But yeah, it's a fascinating story, and like just a because it really like does kind of have like two chapters to it that are very distinct: the setup and then the mission into hell. I also knew that about Roger Stern's run on Doctor Strange. I just hadn't read much of it. To call my shots, the one issue I did pick up was issue number 60, I think it was, which was the issue where Monica Rambeau, Captain Marvel, and the Scarlet Witch guest star against Dracula. So that it was definitely a pretty easy path. That's like something in Avengers referenced that issue, so I had to go get that issue, and nice. That was great. You know, that was a great story right there. But yeah, and I did want to, and I saw this one back on the stands of the day, just never quite pulled the trigger to buy it. But yeah, it's a really a fun story. Seeing early Mignola, where he's really kind of doing, it's very much a superhero story with the way Doctor Strange and Doctor Doom are in this one. But you can still see the hints of the stylizing that he would bring to Hellboy, because hey, where are they going? Where'd they end up?
Right.
But yeah, I it was really good. Now you've made me go like, yes, I need to give that one a reread. Because it there's a lot to it. It's a lot to take in on it. It's a big story in a one little package. Which again, Stern does that so well. He gives you the whole thing right there. So yeah, this is a good one. I'm so glad you picked this one.
Yeah, same as Chris. I never got my hands on it because, well, Marvel graphic novels were especially hard to get in my hometown. Well, next to impossible. So I know I picked up a few maybe like a comic book shop in Montreal or something. But that was a treat and a bit pricey for me. So like I have God Loves, Man Kills. You know, I've got a couple of them. I've got Emperor Doom, but I don't have this one. The virtue of it being Mike Mignola's art is that there are a lot of pages just like by Googling images.
So I
did look. And I've got like a panel in front of me right now where they appear in hell, and Dr. Doom's first reaction is to notice the stench. So see, it's putting us in the scene, you know. It's that human moment from Dr. Doom, who is a somewhat inhuman kind of character. You know, he's so over the top, he's bigger than life. But in that moment, I think he's humbled in a way, and we're seeing like the demons in the, you know, in shadow, because of course it's Mignola. So there's like demonic shadows everywhere, and we're given the thing that we don't get out of a comic, which is the smell of the scene, you know. So it's the little touches like that I always find are just an extra. Like, to me, Roger Stern is a jobber, you know. He is I wouldn't call him an auteur, you know. It's not like, if you're going to read a Frank Miller, you kind of know what you're going to get, good or bad. If you're going to read Morrison or Alan Moore, like, these guys are auteurs with a very specific style, and they're going to completely transform the reading experience. I don't think Roger Stern is an auteur. I think he's like a mainstream comic book writer. So he's doing mainstream superhero work, but there's just like that added layer of craft,
right,
that makes it better than the norm, makes it more memorable, and makes it so that we wanted, you know, that we were happy to follow Tim's lead here and talk about his work. When the name comes up, we're thinking, oh yeah, that story, that story, that story. That's not true of every jobber, you know.
Right. Some other quick hits for other stories by Stern that I would highly recommend. I mentioned at the top, he took over the Fantastic Four after Byrne abruptly left. And he got to write the issues right around issue 300, which was the wedding of Johnny Storm and Alicia Masters, which is a plot that I really, really do not like. But some interesting stories came out of that in the aftermath. But I really like, in issue 299, Johnny asked Ben to be his best man. And you can imagine how that would go over with Ben. And I just like it because the whole thing is Ben is just is fuming, and She-Hulk realizes Ben needs to blow off some steam. Like, he's going to explode. He is so mad right now because of this situation. And what does a guy like the Thing do when he's mad? So She-Hulk provokes him, basically picks a fight with him, keeps egging him on until they start fighting, because She-Hulk is the one person who can take it, who can take the fight. And I just really like that issue because of the way he writes She-Hulk in that issue. And then in 300, which is the wedding issue, I like the Puppet Master, Alicia's father, the Wizard, and the Mad Thinker all team up. They're going to ruin this wedding. They're going to kidnap her, take her away. And at the end of it, the Puppet Master decides, as much as he hates the Fantastic Four, it's his daughter's wedding, and he's not going to ruin that. So he betrays the Mad Thinker and the Wizard and takes them out in order to secure that she has a safe and happy wedding, even without him there. And he's like, this is my wedding present to my daughter. I'm going to make sure that the Fantastic Four villains don't ruin her wedding day. So just those two issues of Stern's brief time on Fantastic Four I thought were really, really well done. Even though I did not like the plot line that he was saddled with handling, he really did some interesting things there. Siskoid, you talked a little bit about it, but anything about the Legion that stood out from his time on that one?
Well, I think he was especially well paired up, I think, like with Jeff Moy, I think, on Legionnaires. So the run from number 35 to number 77, There are a couple of issues that he didn't work on there, like in the middle of it somewhere. But for the most part, Legionnaires 35 to 77, even if you're not really reading the other book, is pretty classic superhero stuff. I think like around issue 50 is like a big Mordru battle. So, you know, so there's some really good stuff there. Shotgun and I have been reviewing the Reboot Legion, which is this is a part of over at the Legion of Super Bloggers. And we, of course, we got through those issues. And I think it's pretty like what was the high point of the so-called Archie Legion? Yeah, around Legionnaires mm-hmm. number 50, which was Roger Stern.
Nice. Chris, I know you were originally going to talk about his Captain America run, and then we realized this is very Marvel-centric, so you took the hit and talked about the Superman story, but any quick thoughts, things that you want to mention about that Captain America story?
I can't not mention two of my favorite comics of all time. That would be Captain America number 253 and 254, which are the Baron Blood storyline, where Captain America is called to England by his old invaders teammate, the original Union Jack, who believes that his brother, Baron Blood, is loose upon the countryside again. And it's like dropping Captain America into a Hammer movie. It's wonderful. There's all these tie-ins to the invaders. You get to see how Spitfire, you know, reacts to now she's aged and Cap's still young. And, you know, the Invaders comics weren't old comics by any means. And all these characters were actually characters of just a fairly recent vintage. But, you know, Stern and Byrne treated them like they are, you know, a rich, deep part of Cap's history. And yeah, he introduces a new Union Jack, as you said, and within the story. And there's a switcheroo there. It's not who you think it is. But you gotta talk about that moment when Cap finally puts an end to Baron Blood, lifts his shield up, and you get that wonderful chuck sound effect and that the silhouette of Cap bringing that sucker down. And the one thing I miss most about Chris Evans probably never playing Cap again is we never got to see that. So and Cindy and I covered that on Supermates, and when we did that synopsis for that one, she should have had the paragraph where we described that, and I jumped over top of her and just read the rest of it because I wasn't going to let her do the Chuck thing. That was mine.
The MCU is doing a Blade movie in the future, so they're going to introduce vampires. Maybe someday I don't know if Chris Evans will come back, but if not him, maybe either Sam Wilson or Bucky, one of them, will get the chance to use the shield to behead a vampire.
I would love to see Anthony Mackie or Sebastian Stan, and really right now, really Anthony Mackie behead a Nazi vampire.
Yes, seriously. Man.
Oh my gosh. That would be awesome.
So cathartic.
All right, Tim. You, as I mentioned, you paid for this one, so I'll give you the last word. Final thoughts on Roger Stern before we go?
Well, it's funny when I'm listening to all the great series and highlights that you guys are pointing out, and I'm going like, yep, I read that. Yep, I read that. Yep, I bought that. Yep, I got that one. So it's so great to hear that the ones that I love are the ones that you guys have loved. It was also really fun. I've had his Captain America run on the to read list for a while, and this was the excuse to get me over the hump to get it started. So thank you for that, Chris. Because yes, I had not read that until just a month ago, and oh my gosh, it is fantastic. So. Yes, I love. But yeah, so there's some earlier Byrne things I really need to get into. I haven't read his Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man run, so I need to get into that. But then some of his later things maybe a little bit too, but boy, I was doing all his DC. So like Power of the Atom and Starman, as well as Starman. And like Power of the Atom, it's like, is it one of the best series that he's ever done? Yeah, your mileage may vary. But still, if you want solid superhero stories, it's right there. But, you know, and we mentioned the Hobgoblin before, and that was, of course, like, I think perhaps his most memorable character and probably his most powerful contribution to the Spider-Man mythos. And getting him to see him come back a couple of decades later and try to redo the origin, the resolution, the who's behind the mask story. I was really glad to see that. I was glad that he got the opportunity to do that and tell it the way that he wanted to. It did not really, it might have felt like Star Wars Special Edition, but I didn't feel like it felt that way. I felt like it was, he was doing, there still was a solid story that he pulled through. So, you know, there's, you know, I don't think we've talked that much about Avengers Under Siege, which I would have to think is, like, to me, is still the high watermark of an Avenger storyline from that era. That's without a doubt. And the single issue number 275, where we have Ant-Man and the Wasp alone against Titania and the Absorbing Man. If you read one issue of Avengers, that's the one to read.
I had a shiver go down my back when you said that, because I love those guys. And that sentence you just said is
oh, that's great. Yeah, that was what Stern also did so well with and had fun with his stories, was the mismatch.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that in the Cap Stern run, Cap and Berna run. Cap facing off against Mr. Hyde. Well, there's some parallels to that later in the Under Siege. Mm-hmm. That certainly was fascinating to see back then. And then Spider-Man versus the Juggernaut. Oh my goodness. And he really liked to do that with the characters. Not really easy way to do with Superman. You can do the mismatch the other way in Superman, but he's usually on top. But facing the hero facing someone who's much overpowering, who can overpower them easily, he would make those really count. So I love those issues. They're so good. So
mismatch.
Thank you for letting me have this moment to talk about that.
Yeah, Tim, the mismatch with any hero within himself is also present, because I think the mismatch is the, like, what Superman is trying to tell Lois Lane his secret. Mm-hmm. That is, or Clark Kent is, that is a mismatch, because this is a situation that we've seen many times. Superman just he's always protecting his identity, not revealing it. Spider-Man does the same in the story you picked. I'd even mention the fact that he made Wasp a leader of the Avengers on par with Captain America.
Yeah.
Now you're talking about 275. When we talk about that era around Under Siege, that's the cover I remember. Ant-Man and the Wasp, mm-hmm. you know, defending against Absorbing Man and Titania. That's, you know, that's the cover I remember of that whole era. So, you know, the idea that the Wasp was such a strong character in his run, it was an achievement in and of itself.
Yeah, the character who you would assume the most diminutive, who you would think would be the smallest and weakest character, is the leader of this team of powerhouses. Yeah, it's incredible.
And in a way, like, kind of the flightiest, because she kept changing.
Yeah.
She kept changing costumes every issue, mm-hmm. Because she was into fashion and drawing her own fashion. She created her own costumes, but it makes her seem kind of flighty. And that's kind of a pun, isn't it?
Right, right.
But exactly. She was one of the original Avengers, so that is totally on point to do that. But I don't think, you know, many writers had thought of doing something quite like that.
Right.
Right. Well, she was saddled with that personality from the very beginning of her first appearances. So, So the writers were kind of locked into that image that she had of herself, almost. How can we even break away from that and make the character still seem like the same character? So that was, but he found a, but he made it happen by making her still a flighty person, still a fun loving person, but decisive and able to inspire. So yeah, it was a one of the best things he ever did was turn her into the leader and make us believe it. I also want to give another shout out, though, to the Legionnaires run, because that was I definitely was all in on the Archie Legion all the way. I enjoyed that run so much. I think one of the first stories Roger Stern did with that was having the headquarters being infiltrated and the and being fought off by Chuck Tane and Tenzel Kem. And I just love that little story because they were not depicted as superheroes at the time. They were the civilians helping maintain the headquarters. But they fought things off, and there's Chuck using his geometry and engineering things to take out the guys. He made the characters a different kind of character. He didn't make them Bouncing Boy and Matter Eater Lad right off the bat, but he was giving us a taste of that and making it fun.
Chris, anything you want to say before we go?
No, I think we actually got a pretty nice selection of what Stern's written over the years. I think we pretty well say it all, and I can't thank Tim enough for suggesting this. I mean, obviously we were all enthused to do it. Like you said, we jumped on it pretty quickly. So it was like, hey, yeah, I could talk about Roger Stern. So I mean, that goes a long way. I mean, to how much, like Sisko said, he's a journeyman writer in a lot of ways because he's had lengthy runs on the Avengers, on Spider-Man, on Superman. And, you know, so it's not like he's a guy that's just come in, done six issues and left. But I mean, he's made an impact on those characters and obviously on at least one or two generations of readers who read those comics when they came out and who are discovering them now in trades or, you know, on apps and with the DC Universe and the Marvel Unlimited. And he's one of those dependable, like Sisko said, he's not the superstar. That's a real good way to put it. He's not the superstar, but he's one of those solid writers that can write within the genre of superhero comics, but also shift from straight superhero action to more the mystic side of things with Doctor Strange and more of the human side of things sometimes with Spider-Man, always keeping that soap opera, that patented Marvel soap opera feel. And he's just one of the best at it.
Well said. I think that's where we're going to go. Tim, the Pod Crasher, Time Priest, where can people find you online if they want to hear more from you?
Well, if they search with Mephisto into the underworld, no, we're not going to do that. No, sorry. I don't know where that came from. Yes, I am regularly a co-host on the Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast from the Right On Network. That's run by Ashford Wright, the regular host of that series. And it was very kind of him to bring me on board. So I've had a lot of fun talking about the character Cassandra Cain over there. Other than that, I just pop up here and there. You can follow me on Twitter at TimPrice17 and find out what shenanigans I'm up to next.
All right. Very, very cool. Listeners, the rest of us can be found here on various shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Thank you all, listeners, so much for tuning in. If you liked our discussion, please support the show on social media by liking or favoriting the posts on Facebook and Twitter. You can leave a comment on the episode post at fireandwaterpodcast.com, and you can always go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave a nice 5-star review for FW Presents or any other show on the Fire and Water Network. Thanks especially to our Patreon supporters like Tim. If you want to donate to the Fire and Water Podcast Network, head on over to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. As always, thank you for listening, and I am going to play us out with one of my favorite Roger Stern songs from the album Dark Side of the Moon.